Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. And you are the only case on our entire docket set for oral submission today, so you're going to have our undivided attention. Understand both sides are ready? Okay. Would you call the case, please?
Dico versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Chris Grace will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew Whitten will argue for the state.
Good afternoon, counsel. I will be brief. I am here primarily in the face of quite a few cases that say I'm wrong. I'm asking you to, go against those cases, overturn them. And essentially, I'm leaning very heavily on Justice Dofino's dissent in Bundy. Bundy, is more on point, and I hope I say this correctly, the Nago case.
We had the same problem.
Oh, so nobody knows.
Beats me.
Great. Anyway, that case set forth that, and what surprised me was in reading that case, if you look at the jury charge, the only difference is they submitted three disjunctive, manners, different crimes, and this one you've got two. But the charge themselves are the same. When you look at the charge, it's going to be commission of this or this or this, and then we're going to find them guilty. And unanimity is only in the boilerplate at the end. That's exactly this case. We only have unanimity in the end of this case, or the end of the charge. Ngo actually has the answer to this problem, and that is put unanimous in each one of those paragraphs so that the jurors know if we're going to find that he intentionally killed somebody, that has to be unanimous. If we're going to find that he performed an act that was intentional, clearly dangerous to human life, that has to be unanimous. We don't have that here. And the harm comes in, again, I will concede, number one, we've got Jefferson out there. We've got Lozano, Bundy, Davis. The same court did all that, Lozano, Bundy, and Davis. And I understand that they've already gone down the path of saying that we don't have this issue. I think we do. I think anybody sitting in the defendant's chair would say we have this issue because the state actually gets up in their closing argument in this case and says it is an either or. Six of you can say intentionally killed her. Six of you can say tried to hurt her to the point that it was clearly dangerous. That's exactly the harm that is shown in the rest of these cases. Unanimity is required by both our Constitution and our Code of Criminal Procedure. Article 5, Section 13, and our Code of Criminal Procedure 3629. Ngo at 705 says unanimity means every juror agrees that the defendant committed the same single specific criminal act. And one of the problems I think we have here is what's the criminal act? And when you look at how this is, the analysis of Justice Dofino and Bundy, I think actually kind of hits the nail on the head that you have to look at the elements of the crime itself to define what that criminal act is. And there is a difference in double jeopardy terms versus jury unanimity. It's a difficult word for me to say, I'm sorry. And I think you, again, are correct in your dissent on that essentially if you go back to what Judge Cochran said about using eighth grade English and breaking things down, you can't have, we have additional elements between the two different, and I'm calling them different crimes. I think they're two separate criminal acts because one is I could intend to harm you in a manner, I could intend to harm you by breaking your femur. That's a serious injury. It's going to take you a long time to heal from that. Did I have any intent to kill you? No. Is an act clearly dangerous to human life? Maybe. If you're 80, probably. If you're 15, no, you heal quickly. So I think some of that is going to be determinative or determined by the facts of each individual case as to which one of these is a crime or would give you the proper intent to find someone guilty of murder. I think
isn't the purpose of murder by doing an act, first of all, you've got the result-oriented offense, which Judge Clinton said is different from the intended act offense, that they are different and to be treated differently. Okay?
Yes.
So murder is a result of the offense, a result offense.
Correct.
You intend the result. You intend to cause the death. The act clearly dangerous, you specifically do not intend to cause the death.
Correct.
So in a Clinton analysis, they would even require different instructions on intent. Remember, because the instruction on intent is intent to do the act or intent to cause the result.
Correct.
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No. You are correct. And then we can also get into the unit of prosecution, the allowable unit. And in murder cases, it's the death of a person. And just like you said in your analysis, there's a difference between, you know, if you kill someone, whether it's felony murder or whether it's intoxication manslaughter, for double jeopardy purposes, you have that one allowable unit of prosecution, and you are correct. When you start talking about how we, I guess my problem is when you sit down and you say, how do we analyze this in a way that we have some sort of confidence that we have the proper jury unanimity, everything gets vague. And it seems to be that when you read the cases, that when we have this result-oriented type case, exactly what you're talking about, we end up in a scenario that says, well, it doesn't matter how you get there, you got the same result. And I don't think that's correct, based on exactly what you're saying. That, no, we, when I was back in law school 100 years ago, we had mens rea and actus reus. And the critical thing was our entire penal system is based upon that criminal intent. And if your criminal intent was to harm someone and it wasn't to kill them, we don't punish them for killing them. We punish them for intending the harm. Now, we get into a bunch of...
But you would require a different instruction on intent, according to Judge Clinton in the cases after that. If it's a result-oriented offense, then the instruction on intent has to be intend to cause the result, and you don't give the general intent instruction, is my recollection.
I think that is correct.
It has been held error to give.
Yes. And one of the problems this is actually before my time, but I think if we went back to special instructions where you broke down each of these elements like they used to do, we would not be having this discussion. I think the problem is you as a reviewing court can't tell what that jury really said or what they were really unanimous about, which violates our Constitution. It violates due process. We need to know what was it you said as a jury, those 12 people said unanimously, this person intended to do.
Or whether they said it unanimously.
I'm sorry?
Or whether they said it unanimously.
Correct. Well, if they can't reach the unanimous verdict, then...
Well, I think that they were told during final argument that six of them could find...
That's exactly what happened here. That's the prosecutor argued, and I've cut that part out, and it's in my brief, said six of you can find one, six of you can find the other, which that would go away if we went through either the special instructions or we included the word unanimous in each one of those paragraphs. At that point, that argument goes away. It's 12 of you have to decide this one or 12 of you have to decide this one. You can't split the baby and everybody go, well, and if we had the third one like they did in the go about the credit card abuse, then four could go one way, four could go another way, four could go another way, and you'd never know. You wouldn't, essentially it would violate your due process rights because we are supposed to have a unanimous verdict. And as a reviewing court, I don't know how you ever know. As a trial court, I'm not sure how you ever know. They follow what they're told to do, but does the trial court really know that that's really what happened? No. Does this court know? No. Even if we took it up from here to the Court of Criminal Appeals, they would not know. Nobody would ever really know, and there's no way to effectively pursue any sort of juror misconduct claim that I've ever seen in this state. And I believe me, I'd like to be able to do that. But the long and short of it is, I think that we've got to find a solution to this. I think that ultimately where you sit is in the seat of how do we know, how do we have confidence that we have a good verdict?
If at trial the intent instruction had been requested, one intent instruction on result, one intent instruction on do the act, would we have this, be faced with this problem now? Wouldn't that require an instruction and a verdict on one, and then an instruction and a verdict on the other?
Okay, if we limit it just to result-oriented conduct.
For the murder.
Correct, for this case.
No, for the murder.
Yes.
The first intentional murder, then would you have to have intent defined according to the result-oriented offense for that verdict form or for that instruction on, you know, the instruction. Now, if you find beyond a reasonable doubt that...
I think you would have to tell them what they would have to find to be intentional, yes.
And then a different intent instruction for act clearly dangerous?
Yes, because I think it's a separate crime. I think you would...
Would that have cured your problem if...
Well, you would have to...
Trial,
I don't know that you can say...
separated?
I think you would have to say intent to kill. Mm-hmm. Did he intend to kill her? And then you would say, did he intend to harm her by using an act that's clearly dangerous?
Right.
I think those are the two questions in this particular case. And you would have to have unanimously associated with both of those intents. Does that answer your question? Because essentially, and that we have other crimes that are not necessarily result-oriented, and then we get into a whole different problem with that.
But I'm talking about this specific case, which is the one that's before us right now.
No. Intent to kill or intent to perform an act that's clearly dangerous to human life. Those are the two questions. They would have to. All that has to be unanimous. Either one. I don't think you can do six. You couldn't come back and say six of intent to kill and six of intent to harm her. I'll concede there were no objections to the charge. And we're in an Almanza egregious harm problem. And the egregious harm, I think, is answered by essentially the argument in closing. And there's a case out of Texarkana Hines at 269 Southwest 3rd 209.
Excuse me, 269?
Southwest 3rd 209. It's just an example of where they tied in how the closing affects that unanimity problem. There's an unreported case out of this court, Barrow, 0213, 187 CR. And that argument is a pretty good example of how they did not necessarily focus on either or. And I think that when you look at those, the difference, at the point in time you go, okay, I have a question as to whether this is a unanimous verdict, and then you get into the argument part where clearly the state is actually forcing that either or. You can do this, or you can do this, or you can do this. We don't really care. Just find them guilty. When that happens and the state focuses on it, that's where we get our egregious harm in Almanza, and that's what happened here. Again, I think this violates due process and just fundamental fairness. I don't know how anybody can really sit here and look at this and go, okay, how do you decide? I understand that you go, okay, he killed her. You make that decision. It's kind of backwards reasoning that we have a death, so everything that happened, no matter how we got there, doesn't matter. It's almost what these arguments seem to say, just because we have the debt. If this were a, and if you go to and go, the credit card abuse, all of a sudden we've got a whole different ball of wax where we've got three separate crimes, but we've got essentially the same charge. And in my mind, if you have an allowable unit of prosecution in that case, it's one, just like this one. You had that card. Now what? I mean, what's the difference between a credit card abuse and a murder when it comes to this analysis? And, you know, we're splitting hairs, but I think that the criminal defendants of this state deserve to know it was unanimous. 12 people sat there and said, this is what happened. And I think, honestly, I know we're not supposed to plagiarize, but I would have just copied your I would have just copied your dissent, because I think that is the proper analysis to go through in this matter, and I do think they are two separate crimes, and it should have been charged in that fashion. Thank you.
Not so fast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had a question about whether, assuming that it is error to have left off the instruction on unanimity, is it harmless if the record shows that under either question, he was guilty?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Okay.
By leaving off the term unanimous, is it harmless?
Is it harmless if the evidence in the record shows that he was guilty under either question, under both questions or either question? I mean, I could see where if there's no evidence.
Correct.
Of one or the other, then that would certainly be harmful. But what if?
Okay.
Essentially,
what you're getting into is a harmless error analysis in a situation where I'm not sure you can do that.
Okay.
And the only reason I say that is because it's, to me, I think it should be presumed harmful at the point in time you have no jury unanimity. And so when you sit down and try to do a harmless error analysis in a situation where you're violating due process and the Constitution, I'm not sure that fits.
I think I get you. I get what you're saying. The way that the Texas Supreme Court analyzes in civil cases would be that paragraph in the rule for reversible error.
Yes.
That says if the error prevents the court of appeals or the appellate court from being able to determine whether there was error, I mean, whether there was harm, then it's presumed. So anyway, I got you.
Right, right. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matthew, do you go by Matthew or Matt?
Matthew. My wife's back there. She calls me Matt. Unless she's mad at me, then she calls me Matthew.
Well, I know most mothers manage to get the full name in there to let you know when you're in trouble.
Yep. Well, may it please the court, counsel. Before I begin, may I introduce Brendan Hyde? He's our new attorney in our appellate division. Yael's Vulin left to go to the public defender's office in Dallas. So you'll be seeing briefs from him, and he's a very bright young man, so we're excited to have him.
Well, welcome.
The jury charge here was put together and designed in reliance on...
Who put it together? Court reporter?
The court puts it together with the help of the attorneys.
So the attorneys actually draft this jury charge?
Sure. Yes, ma'am. So...
The attorneys did? Really?
The attorneys work together with the court to come up with a jury charge, and they have a conference.
Oh, I was on a trial bench, a felony trial bench. And
I
have never seen the lawyers do anything but object to what the court reporter put together.
The attorneys in this case I know that the prosecutors had a hand in designing this jury charge, and that the defense attorneys had input as well. and they had a charge conference. That's how, I hate to use the word always, but that is how it is always done in Denton County District Court.
I've tried cases in Denton County.
I'm not aware of the court reporter having put together the charge. In any event, it was put together and a charge conference was held, and the trial court proceeded in reliance on three cases out of this court, Bundy, Davis, and Lozano. Those cases were decided correctly, and they need not be overturned or reversed.
Well, then how do you square it with Clinton's position that there is a difference between a result-oriented offense and intended act offense?
There is a difference. Murder's a result-oriented offense.
Right.
And the majority, or may have been a plurality opinion in Cook, went further than just saying it was merely a result-oriented offense. Now, that case wasn't about disjunctive jury charge issue, but they said in a prosecution for a result-oriented offense, the intent to gauge in conduct is not a separate element that needs to be proven. And it even went further.
Right.
And said,
it's not irrelevant, but it is not. But if it's intent to cause serious bodily injury, then intent to do the act is significant. That's what makes murder, intentional murder, and intentional act clearly dangerous to human life that resulted in the murder. That was what makes them different offenses. One, you intend the death. The other, you don't intend the death. You just intend to hurt them bad.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive like that. I don't think we can say that. And this case is a perfect example. This woman was stabbed 39 times with a screwdriver. She was hit with the bed frame. Whether he had the intent to cause serious bodily injury, which I think we can all agree that would cause serious, what he did would cause serious bodily injury, or intent to kill, the result was the same.
Well, which did the jury find? Which did all 12 jurors find?
It doesn't matter how the jury resolved a preliminary factual issue of what his intent was when he committed the crime, as long as he had the intent. That's what this whole
line of cases tells us. Wait a minute. No says that's different. No says, no is completely opposite to your position.
But Ngo is not applicable to murder cases. The whole line of cases tells us that already. These are not separate offenses. The trial court relied on that line of reasoning. There's no reason to overturn it. So we can't apply to this case. In Ngo, you had three clearly separate things that could have happened.
There are all ways to commit credit card abuse.
No, there's trying to obtain a fraudulent benefit or trying to pass off something as something else. It's not the end result of, in this case, Ms. Dico being murdered. And the issue, whether it's under B1 or B2, it's a preliminary factual issue. There's no case, I know I'm familiar with the Plunkett v. Estelle Fifth Circuit case. More recently, the Fifth Circuit has said in Price v. Thaler, and I'm sorry, I only have a Lexis site for you. It's 2012 U.S. District Lexis 188505. They cite Bundy and Lozano out of this court, and note that our murder statutes in this case are not separate offenses. They're different they're alternative methods of committing the same offense.
In this case, unlike Gno, in which there were different acts alleged,
right?
Here it's the exact same acts, I believe. Would be each offense.
Yes,
exact same acts, whether he intended to harm or intended to kill.
The exact same act occurred. Whatever his preliminary intent when he killed his wife was, the act was the same and the result was the same. And that's the difference between this case and Ngo and why Ngo wouldn't be applicable in this case. We have some guidance on how the Court of Criminal, let me back up. This court has held that these are not separate offenses, that these are preliminary factual issues. The other Texas courts, appellate courts, have all held the same way. There's no conflict among the courts. We have some indication of how the Court of Criminal Appeals would probably go in Aguirre v. State, 732 Southwest 2nd, 320. It's an older case, 1987. They indicated, this was a sufficiency of the evidence case. It was not a jury charge case. But they did mention and cited a 1983 case out of this court, Riley, 658 Southwest 2nd, 818. The jury had returned a general murder verdict and the conviction was upheld. And they indicated in a note that the murder statute didn't create separate offenses. Again, not a jury charge issue, but I think that could be instructive as this court looks to this issue. In Davis, the court rejected the appellant's petition for discretionary review. And as far as constitutionality goes, the United States Supreme Court has already said in Shad v. Arizona, Arizona murder statute, so not completely the same, but similar circumstances, similar kind of situation, and the unanimity requirement was not violated in that case. The distinction goes to how the defendant in that case committed the murder, not whether he committed the murder, and so there was no due process violation. And as you point out, Justice Gardner, there's one act here, and it goes to the result.
Well, actually, there are about 40 acts.
Yeah. Yes, quite a few. It was brutal.
But how do we deal with Judge Clinton redirected the law in Texas when he said there is a distinction between the result-oriented offense and the intended act offense? Do we just ignore that?
Of course not.
Well, then, of course, tell me how you do it.
Well, one case I believe could be instructive is it's not a murder case. It's an aggravated robbery case, or a burglary case, actually, out of El Paso. Luevano, L-U-E-V-A-N-O, v. State. And again, it's 2012 Westlaw 1883115. And they go through that analysis of what's a preliminary factual issue that a jury doesn't have to be unanimous on in a result-oriented
offense. That's not my question.
Offense.
My question is, what do we do with Judge Clinton's impact on the law when he said there is a... All right.
Was that not a concurring opinion, though?
You take your child to the doctor. The doctor prescribes medicine. You intentionally give your child the medicine. The child has an adverse reaction. You intentionally gave your child that medicine, and the child was injured as a result of your intentional act. You've committed injury to a child. You agree with that? You've committed injury to a child?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Your Honor.
All right, let me try again. The doctor prescribes a medication. You give the medicine to the child as the doctor directed. The child has an adverse reaction and is injured. You intentionally gave the child that medicine.
Of course
have
not,
you
but co- that's the
have end. You committed the offense of injury to a child?
No, absolutely.
Why?
Not. Because the statute of injury to a child is different.
No.
It's not the murder
Why?
Statute.
Why? Why have
you? Intent.
Why have you not committed the offense of injury to a child?
Because that's not a crime under the injury to a child statute.
Yes, it is. Do an act that results in injury to a child, you've committed injury to a child.
Fair enough. I'm not familiar with that fact scenario, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, but I don't exactly follow your question or what you're getting at. What I'm trying to explain, though, is that we have a line of cases that the trial court relied upon here. Trial court, prosecutor, the defense relied on it. There was no objection. Went all the way through. And now, all of a sudden, the appellant wants to overturn this case law, but that's not proper. No other case, there is no opinion, except respectfully, Your Honor, your dissenting opinion in Bundy, that would have us analyze it that way. And so it's not necessary. Are there?
Yes. I was just going to ask you for the citation again in the Louis Vano case.
Yes, ma'am.
Spoke of, I don't see it cited in your brief.
No, it's not in the brief. It's number 810154CR, 2012 Westlaw, 188-3115.
Thank you. I have a question for you.
Yes.
Could you please address opposing counsel's contention that the harmless error rule does not juxtapose with showing egregious harm?
I disagree with his conclusion there, and this case is actually, again, a perfect example of why. The facts in this case are sufficient under, if we consider them separate offenses, the facts of this case would be sufficient under either B1 or B2. That is what tells us, first of all, that these aren't mutually exclusive. That's what I was trying to get at earlier. But in this case, we couldn't have harm in this case because it would be sufficient under one. So even if the jury had only been charged on one or the other, or given two separate questions, or whatever fact scenario we could come up with like that, we would know that the jury was able to unanimously reach that verdict. So there would be no harm. If we can say that, then I think it's too much of a stretch to say we automatically have harm just because something was unanimity requirement was violated.
So you say the evidence shows that he did intend to cause the death and that he didn't intend to cause the death. Is that, you said it showed both beyond a reasonable doubt.
This is where we're hung up. In order to reach, respectfully, Your Honor, your conclusion that these two are separate crimes.
I don't have a conclusion. I'm asking questions so we can get the right conclusion.
The conclusion that you reached in the Bundy case. We have to read extra into that statute under B2. We have to regard those two as mutually exclusive. This case demonstrates why they're not. But we can't look at B2 and say somebody automatically didn't have the intent to kill if they had the intent to commit serious bodily injury, so forth. We can't assume that those two are mutually exclusive. I disagree that they're mutually exclusive, and that's our position. Is there anything else? All right, well, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. It's always wonderful to come down here, and we ask that you affirm the appellant's conviction in this case. Thank you.
Chris?
Briefly, I want to answer Justice Stefano's question. The judge brings a draft of the jury charge to the prosecutor and the defense attorney. We submit the defense if an issue comes up, depending upon who the defense attorney is. I typically will prepare a written request that I know the issue is going to come up and have that filed and ask
for specific instruction.
Right, yeah. And ask for that to be included. But regularly, it's the judge that comes up with them, and I believe they have a bank that they go to receive those. But our court reporters in Denton County absolutely do not come up with the charge.
They're from a bank, right?
Right. And I'm not sure where that bank comes from, and I have been trying to get the courts to use the new pattern jury charges. That hadn't worked at all. So I'd like for them to, because I think they are a little bit clearer. And I think maybe we could avoid some of these issues by not having that conglomeration the way we have it. And I'm again, I'm not quite sure how we get into the harmless error analysis, and I would urge you not to make that when it comes to violations of the Constitution, both the state and federal, with regards to unanimity. And I'd ask that you essentially grant my client a new trial so this can all be fixed. Thank you.
All right, we appreciate your coming here to argue, and until we had a lot of questions. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be in recess, or excuse me, adjourned.